Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Gobeski Wallace Report. I'm Adam Gobeski.
And I'm Charlie Wallace. We've got four guests with us today. We've got Kevin Vredevoog.
Hey, how's it going?
Doug Gobeski.
Hello!
Paul Wilcox.
It's great to be back.
And returning guest after a very long time, Amber Elby.
Hey, everyone. It's great to join you tonight.
When's the last time we had Amber on, Charlie?
I couldn't even say. Probably years. 5 years?
I'm six? Making you say.
Yeah, I would guess like 2019-ish. And actually, I don't know if I've ever been on this podcast. I was on Cinematic Respect, but...
You have been on this podcast because I remember we talked about Cauldron's Bubble at one point.
Oh, so. That's right. You were my very first. That was 2017.
Oh,
that
wow.
That was the last one. And so thanks for finally deciding that you wanted to talk to me again.
Well, that's because... how do I put this? I thought maybe you could sanction our buffoonery when it came to the 15th installment of the Sci-Fi Shuffle, which is the 1927 silent classic Metropolis, which I believe is one of your favorite films. Is that safe to say?
It is. And I love how you reached out to me about this, because I got a text from Adam that was like, is this Amber's number? And then it was like... If I remember correctly, don't you like Metropolis? And both of those things were true. So that's fine.
Look, I didn't want it to come back that we had done an episode of Metropolis without asking you, and then I would never hear the end of it. So I'm avoiding that future.
I would have found out, too, because we actually do listen to you all. So.
Oh, dear. All right. Oh.
What?
Paul just got more scared.
And yet you still showed up.
But do you listen to it on headphones, or can other people around you hear it?
You didn't tell anyone about it, did you?
I've listened to it shopping before, like in my headphones while I'm
shopping. Oh, okay.
Not just on your boombox so everyone in the store can hear it.
Adam, was your pick this week? Why Metropolis?
I think partly it was just a lot of the movies we've watched recently have been more sort of either lesser known or cult classics kind of things. So I think I just wanted to pick something a little more well-regarded in the genre, something that lots of people knew and in many ways is a seminal science fiction movie.
Boys, he is just crapping all over our choices, isn't he? He's like, I wanted to pick something good.
Well, no, I mean, if you think about, like, you say, what's a classic sci-fi movie? I mean, we did 2001, like, right off the bat. We've done a lot of great movies, I think. But, yeah, if you had, like, 100 people give you a list, this would be on many of them.
I've wondered before if this is, like, classic in the Mark Twain sense, though, where everyone talks about it, but no one actually watches it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't seen it.
Yeah, it's referenced all the time in film classes. And I have a graduate degree in film, and I never watched it until after I graduated. So, like, I was aware of its existence, but, you know, just like a lot of people know of Great Expectations but don't read it, this is how Metropolis fits into our popular culture in a way.
Yeah, I think part of that is because, while maybe the general public hasn't seen it, a lot of people who did see it went on to, this is a Velvet Underground reference basically, isn't it? Went on to make movies that were inspired by it. And I think even if you haven't seen the whole movie, you've definitely seen shots of like the Machine Man or the skyline, that kind of thing of the city. So I think even if people aren't necessarily familiar with the full movie, they're familiar at least with some of the imagery.
So it's fun to look at this, too, when you haven't seen it like how Charlie did, because it's almost like Hamlet, where when you see or read Hamlet for the first time, you're like, oh, this is where we get words like mind's eye, or this is where we get the skull imagery. And for this, you're like, oh, this is where we got the like the dude with the clock. Or when my husband and I were watching it, we were like, oh, this is where the girl in the tube from The Fifth Element came from. And there's so many visual things that seem familiar because, as Adam said, like everyone who's made films has seen this, and it's seeped in little parts into a large, well, vast components of our culture.
And so,
back up. What was that about the clock?
The dude with the clock.
The guy who's moving, when he's moving the clock hands around.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, what you see similar stuff in, like, Modern Times and things like that.
Really?
Yes.
Like what?
I think Modern Times was the name of the movie.
Oh!
That was I'm piecing it together. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. The chaplain.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
So this is a good place to have all of us talk about whether we've seen this before. I had, as I mentioned, not seen this before. I don't have any particular reason why. I don't know. It's maybe there's something about like the public domain, like old silent film stuff where it's like it's not being thrown in front of my face for people to try to make a profit off of me watching it. So I just don't even think about it a lot of the time.
It's never been algorithmically delivered.
Yeah, like when we were talking about eyeballs. Like where to watch this, and Kevin's like, I'm watching it on YouTube. I'm like, oh, yeah, you probably can just watch this on YouTube.
But have you seen the anime?
I had seen the anime. Actually, I do have that on DVD. It's been a long time since I've seen that, too.
And I've been wanting to watch that anime, and I feel like there's not a lot of great places to watch it.
Your house. Movie theater.
Cruise ship.
Cruise ship. You know what? This is, I'm glad this is the education podcast.
I actually own the anime on DVD, and I've never seen it. A friend gave it to me, and I was like, I will definitely watch this, and then I never did. So my first time watching this was when I was fresh out of grad school. I got a teaching job. I got to teach a high school science fiction course that was already partially built by the teacher before me who had quit over the summer. So I was told that I was teaching Metropolis. And I watched it maybe a couple of weeks before the semester started. And I saw the old version of it, the shorter version. And it was much more than I expected emotionally. Like, I started watching it and I kind of had to pee. And I was like, I'll just pause it in the middle and get up and go to the bathroom. And then, like, I'll get some popcorn and other stuff, too. And then I ended up watching the whole thing with no break. And I really had to pee by the end. And
this turned into a rock story.
No. So I'm such a dork. Like, my husband came home and I was like on the sofa crying, like watching the end of the movie. And I was like, it's so beautiful. And I really have to pee. So that was my first experience. And then for Christmas, when the extended Buenos Aires version came out on DVD, my husband gave it to me as a Christmas present.
I think my dad may have had like the VHS version, maybe of the Giorgio Moroder version, possibly, that I kind of vaguely recall walking in and out of, but not really watching. And then when the complete quote-unquote version was recovered and released out on DVD and Blu-ray, at some point I was like, you know, I should check that out. So I bought a used copy of the Blu-ray and watched it. And I think seem to recall at the time thinking it was quite boring, honestly. And then I rewatched it this time, and I was much more engaged. So I might have just not been in the right frame of mind at that point.
So what Adam is apparently misremembering here is that I purchased a copy of it on VHS from a garage sale. And I half watched it. It was pretty much incomprehensible to me. As foreign films on VHS seem to be, as my experience with Akira can attest.
Tetsuo!
So I guess I had seen that version, and this was my first time seeing the movie since, and also the first time seeing the almost complete version, with there being no extant complete version.
I think this one's only missing about 5 minutes, though. It's a small amount, but it seems like a scene that I would want to see, because those of you who haven't seen the film, it just kind of goes to black, and then there's a written description of what happens during the part that's missing.
So which yeah, scene?
They were pretty significant. I don't know if y'all's cuts had the, like, here's what would be happening if yeah, we had the footage that. Intertitles yeah. in those, but there's...
Yeah, one of them seemed like a big fight.
Yeah, yeah, like the two of the major characters fight and one of them wins was just kind of a little bit anticlimactic there. And I also would have liked to see earlier on, it wasn't as integral, but there was a priest or something that was giving a speech that it seems like they call back to later when Fredder is hallucinating. I just visually, I think it would have been more impactful had we seen the first guy rather than just see the hallucination version.
So really quick, just in case you don't know, Metropolis is a guy who built a city, and he has a bunch of workers who help run it. And so all the rich people get richer and all the poor people stay poor. And so the poor people are kind of upset. But there's this woman named Maria who's like, just wait, like, basically the Messiah will come. I mean, they don't put it in those terms, but that's kind of the vibe. And then the son of the architect, hint, hint, comes down to mediate between the two and stuff happens. And also there's a robot lady because there's a crazy inventor who is obsessed with the wife of the architect who has passed away. Basically what I'm saying, and this may just be for Doug, is this is the sequel to Megalopolis.
Ah.
They just changed some names. It's no longer Caesar Catalina. Now it's Yo Fredersen or something. But I think this is just the next chapter in that story.
And the whole thing is built around opposites as well. So there's like the city that's up above where the rich people live and there's the light. And then there's the underground city where the workers live and it's dark. There's technology contrasted with religion and like gothic cathedral kind of scenes going along with the creation of this robot lady. And so everything is a duality. And that's part of what makes it cool, too.
Definitely. As far as production goes, yeah, we should talk a little bit about this just because it is relevant as to why we keep saying things like the nearly complete version and stuff. Despite being pretty expensive at the time, I don't think there was anything terribly unusual about the production. Supposedly, the director, Fritz Lang, went to the United States and saw things like New York and Hollywood and noticed that like all their buildings are sort of vertical, which is not really how things were in Europe at that point. And so that visually inspired him to with some of the imagery. He had already been working on the storyline with his collaborator, Thea von Harbo. Fritz Lang was a very exacting director. He reportedly wanted many, many takes until he was satisfied with things. Birgitta Helm, who plays Maria, is also, for some reason, the person inside the machine man costume, which, you know, these days you just stick a random guy in there, a visual effects guy, but for whatever reason, it's actually her in there. And at one point, because it was so restrictive and stuff, she apparently passed out from lack of air because the scene was taking too long, stuff like that. There was also an issue where, for a while, the machine man was replaced by a Cyberman, and the Cyberman was causing problems, but fortunately the Ninth Doctor showed up and took care of that. And so,
okay, while you're leading up to that, I was going to say, what's the difference between a robot person and a Cyberman?
I understood that reference only because I read the Wikipedia page immediately before coming on here and saw that there was actually some sort of audio play in which that happened.
Yeah, oh, it's an audio play.
Yeah, it's a Big Finish, which I've listened to. It's on my shelf. So big Ninth Doctor fan over here. Anyway, I just want to slip that in. So Fritz Lang comes up with his final cut, runs about 2.5 hours. He has a big premiere in Berlin, and this is a very expensive film, but UFA, the production company, thinks they can make their money back by distributing it in the United States. It seems like the sort of thing that would go over big in the US. So he goes, and by he I actually mean UFA, they go and talk to Paramount and say, hey, you should share this movie. And they say, well, sure, but it's way too long, you need to cut an hour out. Paramount hires someone to basically recut the film and shorten it down. That is a playwright named Channing Pollack, who is quoted as saying that in the original film, symbolism runs such riot that people who saw it couldn't tell what the picture was all about. I have given it my meaning. Fritz Lang was pretty upset about that. He at one point said to British journalists, I love films, so I shall never go to America. Their experts have slashed my best film, Metropolis, so cruelly that I dare not see it while I am in England. That's slightly ironic because he will flee to the United States as the Nazis come to power, because Fritz Lang is half Jewish. So this thing gets cut down to incorporate Paramount's edits. They lose about an hour. There were three negatives, and each negative was apparently cut by a different country. So the US cut one, Britain cut one that was basically about the same, and then Germany cut one to be in line with those. And so that meant there was a lot of footage that was missing. And so this became one of like the holy grails of like lost footage, along with finding the lost footage from Eric von Stroheim's epic Greed and recovering the lost film London After Midnight. To date, neither of those things have happened. Oh, and sorry, and the Magnificent Ambersons finding Orson Welles' original cut. That's also up there. But Metropolis was also one of those. People had sort of given up. In 2001, they basically put together a restoration of all the little pieces that they had found, along with some extra information. Part of the issue, though, that they had was that there's no existing script. There's like no camera script or anything that would describe this what's going on. So they were doing sort of best guesses. Then in 2008, a reporter got wind of hearing someone had screened a version of Metropolis in Argentina and had been surprised at how long it was. And so they went down there and discovered that they had actually a print of more or less the complete Metropolis as Fritz Lang had originally intended it to be. An Argentinian distributor had visited Berlin shortly after the Berlin premiere and had a 35 millimeter copy struck, presumably with the intent of distributing it in Argentina. Nothing became of that. The film fell into private hands and then eventually was donated to a museum in Argentina. At some point, they're not quite sure when, but they're guessing sometime in the 70s, because film stock of that age, nitrate, is highly, highly flammable. So they decided to make a safety copy of it, but they didn't have a lot of money. So the best they could manage was a 16 millimeter. And they didn't have really the resources or the technology at that point really to clean the print. So they just copied it as is, which meant that this print that was already pretty dirty, all that dirt and all the scratches and things like that got printed onto the 16 millimeter. It's also a fact that 16 millimeter, just by its nature, doesn't quite have the same aspect ratio as 35. And so a bit of frame information was lost as well. But they discovered this in 2008. They were like, holy crap, it's here. At roughly around the same time, a little bit earlier, someone had recovered the original score that Gottfried Huppertz had composed for the film's premiere in Berlin. And that had detailed notes in it that included things like this scene happens here, that kind of stuff for measures so that they, the orchestra, could keep in time. So using that and the Argentina version, they compiled it together. Noticing at the time while they were doing that, that some of the scenes in their original 2001 restoration were actually not quite in the right spots relative to where Fritz Lang had put them. So they moved around all that kind of stuff. A couple sections, as we've noted, about 5 minutes or so, were either missing or unrecoverable. They were so bad, in such poor condition, that they simply couldn't be restored in any way. And so Metropolis is still missing those segments, but this is about as complete as it's going to get, most likely. Did I get that more or less right, Amber, roughly?
Yeah, that was good. I'm sure that your listeners are well aware that old film wasn't valued the way that we value things today. There wasn't the sense of, like, we have to preserve this thing. That's why we've lost a bunch of television as well. And also, as you noted, if you've seen Inglourious Basterds, you know what happens to film when it's exposed to flames. There wasn't a lot of people who would volunteer to, like, house these old films that were just sitting around. So that's why we've lost so much film history over the years.
Many of them who did then got hit, but when they ignited spontaneously and then destroyed large film archives.
Yeah. So the moral is, don't collect things that are flammable. And then the other moral is, don't film on film that is flammable, and then it'll last.
You can see nipples in this movie.
Yeah. I noticed that. I mean, it's 1927, so, and also in Germany. So, yeah. I was a little surprised, but then I was like, oh, yeah, of course it makes sense.
I love that bit. I don't think that was in the original cut that I saw. And when I saw it, I was like, oh, this is a great contrast to when Frieder first meets Maria, because he has these women who are objects, like dancing around him in the garden with their nipples sticking out, as you guys observed.
Yeah.
And then in walks this very matronly but still beautiful young woman surrounded by children, like sharing this message of equality. And that's when Frieder very dramatically grabs his heart to let everyone know that he's instantly fallen in love. And it doesn't have the same effect without the scantily clad women in the tri-corner hats.
Yeah.
Sorry, you just reminded me of the tri-corner hats. I forgot about that.
It's a nice touch, the tri-corner.
So, Charlie, tell us about the Nazis.
What do you want to know? Now,
how do the Nazis feel about this movie?
This is one of those movies that it's sometimes a little hard to approach if you don't know much about it. Because, I mean, if somebody asked me, like, before today, I'd be like, oh, yeah, isn't that, like, kind of a Nazi movie or something? But what it turns out that Fritz Lang actually, you know, obviously made this in Germany. And Joseph Goebbels invited him to his office. And Fritz Lang was kind of expecting, you know, what I guess any half-Jew, also creative at the time, was expecting, which is that Goebbels was going to tell him, yeah, I don't like what you do and you better stop doing it. But it turns out when he got there, he said, oh, actually, Hitler and I really, really like your movie and we'd like to promote it as sort of like a Nazi propaganda film. At which point Fritz Lang was like, all right, I'll think about it. And then he fled Germany. So it's one of these things that, you know, Hitler and the Third Reich picked up on and kind of promoted as a pro-Nazi film. And I guess we can discuss whether we really think it falls under that category or not. Fritz Lang's wife at the time, Thea von Harbo, actually did end up working creatively with the Nazis after they were divorced. So it's possible that some of that sentiment is in the movie, but I don't know if it's particularly obvious. This could be a situation where it's people enjoy something and then see into it what they want to see into it. I guess kind of what I'm saying is that I bet Hitler would have really been into Fight Club if he was around at that time.
So what you're saying is Fritz Lang's no Leni Riefenstahl.
No.
That's the director of Triumph of the Will, among other things.
Can I interject on an unrelated thing?
Yeah,
why do you all keep pronouncing his name Lang?
Long? Is it Long?
It's Fritz Lang.
Fritz Lang. It's because, well,
I think it's
I'm American.
Because it's Scott Lang and not Scott Long.
Yeah, but he's not German.
Or I will correct myself in the future as appropriate.
According to anyway.
So to circle back to
it's a fair point.
I looked it up and it does say that it's Long on Wikipedia. So
good to know.
So to circle back to the Nazis, I feel like they could have just watched the first 10 minutes or so and gotten up to the point with the pretty boys who are running the track events. And they're like, this is the perfect movie. This is exactly what we want our society to be. And then they got drunk and missed the whole point at the end with like unity and equality and all of those things that they definitely didn't practice in real life. And so I don't think that they appreciated it for the same reasons that like 21st century Americans would in terms of ideology.
I actually thought it was kind of, I don't know if it's bold or obvious. It feels bold nowadays to like have your mission statement at the very beginning and very end of the movie, just like written on the screen.
No one misses it.
Yeah, no, I thought it worked. It's like, oh, okay, I know what this is going to be about.
All right, well, Paul and Kevin.
This is a pro-union movie. You know,
I mean, Romeo and Juliet tells us at the beginning who's going to die. It's just an old storytelling form, right? In case you don't pay attention.
Yeah.
That's why everyone hates Romeo and Juliet, though.
I take offense.
Like, this is the worst play ever. I won't stand for
this Baz Luhrmann slander.
Hey, Kevin and Paul, we're done talking about Nazis, so we can talk about the movie.
Hooray!
All right.
So what's something that struck you guys about this, just watching it for the first time?
So for me, go ahead, go for it.
I was just going to say, I don't think I've really ever watched a silent film.
That was literally the exact thing I was going to bring up.
Sorry, no.
Could have said it simultaneously.
Well, you'll have some input too then, because... You know, I was like, wow, there's lots of heart. Everyone's clutching their chests. You know, was literally, that something that people did in the 20s?
Like, just the style of silent film acting. I love it. And I know at the time it wasn't like they wouldn't perceive it the way we are perceiving it now. But there's just something so, I don't know, pure about it almost. Just like it is raw emotion because they have nothing to show us what they're, you know, saying, feeling, whatever with, except their body language. It did verge on a little extra every now and then, like when Maria was showing that she was distressed by like randomly like running from wall to wall and basically bouncing around. But I don't know. There was something about it I really deeply enjoyed.
There were a lot less inner titles than I kind of expected in this too. Like every time I expected one to pop up, they just didn't do it. And I was like, oh, I guess they didn't really need it there. I know what they're saying.
Yeah, I felt like almost like it was kind of, I was pretty impressed in like how well I'm like, okay, you're kind of expected to, I mean, even some of the exact dialogue, not that I, you know German or anything, but I'm like, okay, clearly he's saying father there, you know, Vater.
It sounds like father. It's just with a T instead of a T.
Oh, okay. Vater.
Vater, yeah.
But I feel like I don't know, there's just so many other context clues and like the acting is so strong that you just kind of fill in enough of the blanks that it almost felt like the text was, you know, more of a last resort, you know, for instance, like when, you know, to at least tell some kind of detail aside from the ones you can infer.
How do I act out that the entire city is going to be flooded? Well, yeah, we can put that on the screen.
Have a pantomime like water or something, you know, it's like if it charades. Doesn't work in charades, you put up a card.
One thing I found, I don't know if upsetting is the right word, but the story, despite being 100 years old, still pretty relevant. Like you could release an updated version of this without changing much as far as the overall story arc, and people would say it continues to be edgy or whatever today. Like it was disheartening to see that, like, yep, they were thinking the exact same thing 100 years ago that we're all thinking, you know, now in the present, that maybe this whole wealth inequality, whatever gap is maybe not the best. And maybe, you know, we need to bridge that a little bit.
I don't know. It might be worth noting that in 1927, when this movie was made, Germany had only recently recovered from very high inflation, which happened from like 1921 to 1923 for a number of factors. But basically inflation, like you thought we had inflation the last couple of years, not even close to what they were experiencing.
Yeah, it's like wheelbarrows full of money, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, to buy like a loaf of bread. Credit, I guess, to the Weimar Republic people in charge at the time that they were able to actually get that under control. But I think that probably would have been fresh in a lot of people's memory, at least in Germany. And so that may have exacerbated that feeling of inequality as a result. I'm speculating here, but it doesn't seem that unreasonable to me.
I actually hadn't watched this movie for many years before I got Adam's text because it does seem too relevant. It's concerning to think about how divided our country is and has been, and then watch this. But like a good dystopia, it continues to be relevant. That's why this genre works. But it is, I made the mistake of watching this on election night as the numbers were coming in. In retrospect, I should have watched V for Vendetta because it was November 5th. But this sparked some different emotions this time around than in previous watchings.
All we need is for Baron Trump to fall in love with a poor person and everything will be fine.
The head and the heart.
We just have to hope that Elon Musk builds a robot in time.
God.
So technical So I've got a technical filmmaking question. Why was it recorded at one speed and then played back at a different speed, like sped up speed?
Well, generally speaking, that's just a silent movie technique. They would film at a slightly lower speed to what we're used to, and then they would speed it up just to kind of keep things moving, or because they could get away with more if you are slightly sped up, like things become a little less obvious timing wise that you're deliberately doing things, stuff like that. And I think it was also just kind of the language that they had settled upon. And the reason we no longer do it at that rate is because sound had to come in and that had to settle at a synchronized rate relative to the speed, and 24 frames per second is what we settled on. But yeah, a lot of silent films run at 20 frames per second, 18 frames per second, sometimes like 22, maybe even sometimes 24. It really depends on the film. And yeah, sometimes there actually is debate about what speed a film actually should be run at. And so that's why sometimes you'll get slightly different versions. And a lot of times silent films are discussed in terms of their length, in terms of the actual length of the film itself. Like they'll say like
feet.
Yeah, length of, yeah, feet, exactly, rather than time.
There was a scene there where a guy lights a match and then lights his cigarette. And that one was where it was the most obvious that they had sped up the film because the smoke just moved too fast. Like I could accept the people moving fast as just kind of a stylistic choice, but like seeing the smoke moving too fast was like, wait a second.
Yeah, all that said, I think we do more or less know that this is the speed Metropolis is meant to be run at because, well, partly because we know how long the Berlin premiere was, but also okay. We have the score. So unless you think the score was, you know, slowed down or something relative to the film, but...
Man, can you imagine this movie being slowed down to be played in real time? Be like 3 hours long, geez, 3.5, something like that. The answer pretty much comes down to it's a stylistic choice and it's intentional.
So there wasn't a standard frames per second at the time?
Yeah, that's just partly a stylistic choice. That's what I think people sort of expected at that point.
So speaking of stylistic choices, I was really curious what you guys thought about the sexy robot dance.
Which one? As the robot?
Yeah, when the robot seduces the people at the nightclub and convinces them to start rioting.
Oh, so not like when the robot just gets up, like in a still a robot. You mean okay.
Yeah.
Well, she does kind of shimmy as the robot. And I'm okay, interesting.
Yeah, when she puts her arms out, I was like, oh, man, she's doing the robot, basically. And that was an intense scene with those guys going just crazy. I don't know.
I loved the way, and I've already forgotten the actress's name, but the way she distinguished Helm, when Helm, the way she distinguished Maria from the robot, just the way she was acting with her body, just with those weird, I don't know, kind of claw jerky motions. I mean, I thought it was excellent.
And the way she would close one eye a bit.
Yeah. I thought she was good as Maria, but she's playing kind of a stereotypical female character. But when she started doing all of the robot stuff, it was like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic.
So I have a fan.
You were on board with the belly dance.
So, it was, at first I thought it was purely the whole scene where, they're starting to literally salivate. It was a little okay, I guess this is what movies used to be like.
They got to throw a scene in there for the boys or whatever.
But what I really like is because the Argentinian footage is so different in quality, it's easy to tell where it's been dropped in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so what was cut for America versus what wasn't. And so huge parts of the climax, America's they don't need to know that. They don't need to know there was some complication with the door when the kids were getting out or stuff like that.
Right, right.
But that belly dance, every second.
Look, man, if you're gonna have the Whore of shots, Babylon, you gotta emphasize the whore part, right?
I mean, that is a very fair point, to be honest. So
it didn't feel exploitative because the whole point was she was exploiting them. That's I think what kind of made me feel a little bit better about it, that this was her plan. It wasn't just you can point to a million B movies where for no particular reason they just have a half naked woman doing a dance number to draw people in.
Star Trek
and this,
5.
Yep. And this did not feel like that.
So I have a fangirl hot take for this one. And I don't I'm
we're
sure
a fangirl?
I'm a fangirl. And so
we're a fan dance girl. Never mind.
Sure.
Star Trek 5.
Uhura, yes.
So this is true. In World War One, they used to calm troops in France by sending ballet dancers to perform for them. And the idea was that the soldiers would watch the ballet dancers and their graceful movements would make them forget about all the atrocities of war. And they would like think for a moment that they were watching some angelic figure. And that robot dance that Maria does is the opposite of ballet. Like, there's nothing smooth. All of her body movements angular. So if you assume that ballet is going to be calming to large groups of men, then the robot dance would be the opposite of that, and it would incite them to violence. And so that's what happens.
I'm gonna go into incognito mode and search naked robot dance.
There's no way that turns out well, side note.
I mean, obviously, things in this movie are pretty heightened, but I was wondering, if does the robot have special powers to make the men do that? Or is it just we live in a universe where men are driven to murder each other by watching a dance?
I assumed the latter. Part of the, you know, surrealism or whatever you call the general vibe of a movie like this, you just have to accept that her dance was so amazing that they just lost their minds.
Well, I mean, also, they specifically patterned the robot after Maria because they knew that the people were following Maria. You know, it basically
just got that thing,
like it's the celebrity. It's not just the content. It's
But were those guys up there? I thought
that was good. I agree. The people who were, well, I guess both were driven to murder, but the people who were danced for was the upper crust. But I guess you could say Frater, son of Joe Fraterson.
Yo Fraterson,
excuse me.
It's interesting that the son doesn't have the set.
Fraterson's son, that they always refer to him. Yeah.
Fraterson.
Yeah.
He immediately fell head over heels, so maybe there is just some sort of ethereal attraction to this woman for whatever reason.
She has Orion pheromones.
Could be, as does the robot version of her.
It's a very accurate copy.
I didn't really get the movement quite right, but other than that, yeah.
I was wondering if I was not kind of ready for the Moloch scene. In that, I immediately interpreted that. I was like, I'm watching a sci-fi movie. Crazy stuff is going to happen. And I'm like, okay, so they literally unearth some Moloch underground, and now they're going to tell the boss. And then he's just like, it's an explosion. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's not so bad, I guess.
It's symbolism, Paul.
it took me a second to get it. I wonder if that's what that you know, those terrible American critics were thinking. they were as dumb as I was.
No, I was the same way at that scene. I was like, did something literally? I was like, they're actually feeding the people to the machine, and then it turned back, and I was like, oh no, that was just in his head. It's like it's a good scene. It worked really well. Yeah.
And Frater's hallucinations are fun, though, because when he has the hallucinations about the sins later, and it sets it up too. I loved watching that with my husband, who has absolutely no memory of seeing this film before we watched it on election night, even though he's seen it before. when they first showed the statues of the sins, he was like, those are creepy. And I was like, just you wait. And then I said something later on about the nightmare fuels coming up, and I started moving and he was not okay. But that's a really fun hallucination too. I like seeing the world through Frater's eyes as he's descending into the depths of his own mind.
Yeah, but the first time they showed those, the sins and death, I was like, oh, that death's going to move. That's a dude. I can tell.
It's like in a cartoon, you know, where you can see what's gonna, you know, you can see the cell versus the background.
That right. One patch of grass, something's gonna happen with that patch of grass over there.
I've seen enough DuckTales to know that that's gonna
move. So since you brought up the Disney thing, earlier you were talking about how when Maria's like running and it's showing her distress, she runs into the walls and like kind of pulls at her hair. That was so mm-hmm. Snow White. And I was thinking during that part, I was like, man, Walt Disney watched this. Like he saw this, or his animators did. And I loved looking for little parts in this where it's like, yeah, some like Ray Bradbury must have been aware of this stuff. Like you see the little reflections of it in later fiction. So are you all folks who are familiar with Broadway shows apart from Adam, who I assume is?
Is this where you plug your play?
No, no, jeez, absolutely not.
There is this where you reveal
because, as it turns out, I've got something coming out soon.
So there's this Tony Award-winning musical called Hades Town.
Yeah, I'm seeing it. Sorry, I'm seeing it in like 2 months. I'm so excited.
Okay.
No spoilers. Oh, so no spoilers. No spoilers.
I have listened to the entire soundtrack probably for a year straight. So like I'm not worried about spoilers.
So
at least.
Are you seeing it in New York?
No. It's finally coming through Detroit. It's going to be at the Fisher Theater in January.
So I got to see it in New York over the summer, and I ran into Jordan Fisher beforehand, accidentally. He plays Orpheus, and like I met him petting a dog, which was weird. But the reason I was at Hadestown is because one of my friends texted me and was like, there's this musical that is Metropolis, except it's the Orpheus. And it so is. And I don't think that it's as evident if you just listen to the soundtrack, but when you see it, you'll...
No, I've seen enough of the visuals. I mean, really, the workers in Hades, like, absolutely. I did not make that connection in watching it, but as you say it, yeah, thematically, a lot of overlap.
One of the big set pieces was, like, a big whistle that looks like the whistle that they keep on showing in Metropolis. And they did stuff where they had, like, candelabras that kind of looked like gears, and they would dance around with them, and it looks so much like the underworld of Metropolis.
Yeah, one thing I noticed about this movie is how choreographed a lot of the worker movements are. Yeah, it's very stage-like.
Yeah, it's like dancing. Yeah,
move. Mm-hmm. Yeah, back and
the
forth.
The entire
levers or whatever.
Like the first 10 minutes or whatever of the movie where it's just showing them working and everything down to their footsteps is maybe not in perfect sync, but very closely synced with the music. I really enjoyed that. Really, anytime they're working in the machine factory, just the way they even designed the machines, like the clock guy who's moving those gigantic hands around, or just all the random levers that people are trying and nearly passing out while... flicking. I loved the set designs for that entire area as well.
And the whole thing is so beautiful, and you care about it to a degree that isn't rational. Like, I really cared about the clock guy. And when you think about it, it's like he's not integral to the plot in the same way that, like, Frieder is. But I really cared about, like, what his storyline was going to be. And I think that part of that is because he was such a visually appealing character, not like that he was hot, not like, you know, we would perhaps associate with modern actors where they have to be beautiful for you to sympathize with them. But because of the way that he was constructed within the shot, it was gorgeous. And Adam, when you gave your history of this earlier, I really wanted to add too that so much of this kind of set the standards for production design. And like doing the miniatures and setting up the shots exactly what they were, like as they were, like it comes up again and again in film, that kind of cinematic construction. Even something like my all-time favorite short film, which is George Lucas in Love, it has a shot that looks like the robot, and it's just like a little 2-second shot, but it's like, oh, that's from Metropolis, and it's so beautiful because it looks like that. And you all should see George Lucas in Love.
Seen it. It's good. Nice.
I was going to say, speaking of unbeautiful people who I enjoyed, I think his name is just The Thin Man, but like, like that guy was fantastic. His whole vibe, every movement he made was just kind of eerie and terrifying. And that was the role he was born to play. I loved him every second he was on the screen. His gigantic hat was great.
His gloves.
His head in profile in that one shot, we were like, that's what it looks like. You know?
What I thought was fun too was that he's, I guess, for lack of a better word, slightly more reasonable than you think he would be. Like when he's threatening that the assistant who gets fired.
Hostafat, I think.
Yes. when he's at his apartment and he's threatening him. He's like, you better take this money and I don't want to see you here. And he's like, no, I don't want the money. He's like, I'm going to give you even more money. How about this check in my pocketbook as well? Oh, you're going to try to escape. Well, I'm going to just pry your hand off of here and then you better leave later. Like most other movies, I would expect that guy to be dead already.
Yeah. The actor is Fritz Rasp.
Fritz Rasp. Nope.
His obituary in Der Spiegel described Rasp as, quote, the German film villain in service for over 60 years.
I mean, he kind of like set the stage for the next 100 years of like scary German henchmen. Like,
yeah.
Or even like, I mean, he kind of had a Slender Man vibe just with the, you know, like really nicely, you know, suited character with just kind of a scary little face on him.
And then he gets a line. I don't remember what it is. A line like towards the end of the movie that he says to Frederson. Isn't it something like, I'm trying to remember what it is. It's like, yeah, it's so like your son.
Frederson's. Yeah. Worried about his son, like, where's my son? And then he says back to him, like, thousands of people will be asking you that same question tomorrow, yeah. Or something like that.
A good line, but it's like, oh, this guy's deep, damn. Too.
Something, you mentioned the apartment scene, something that stood out to me there, and repeatedly through the movie, actually, but mainly in the apartment scene, like, past future elevator technology just stresses me out. Like, it feels like people should constantly be losing limbs or getting decapitated in the elevator systems that they've set up.
They probably do, but you know.
Are they just building new compartments at the top and then burning them at the bottom? They only go one way.
Shrug.
Oh, I'm sure it's a loop.
I guess flip over and then. Yeah.
I was so worried about the actors for that. And with the flood, too. I just kept on thinking about the OSHA violations and all of that.
Yeah, or even like some of the climbing of stairs or things near stairs. Yeah. It seemed like, oh, those are real actors. And they're definitely, like, it's probably not as high as it looks, but they're not close to the ground either.
There's a lot of crowd crush triggers.
With children.
I was like, oh, there's a huge flood of people, you know, where the beginning can't see the end, and then they run up against a bunch of iron bars.
This is according to Thea von Harbo, so, you know, maybe a biased source, but she said that the kids loved being on set.
That's what I was going to say. It's like, it's a big splash pad. They just running around. Run from here to there.
Also, apparently, they were getting, like, a warm place to sleep, like, three square meals a day.
Oh, God. Like, all that so kind of stuff. So they were desperate, of course.
And they were having a great time.
And they recovered over 90% of their bodies afterwards. So.
They were typecast.
Oh.
But another thing that's sad to think about that, of course, I was thinking about when I was watching it is imagine being in the center of those trudging workers at the beginning and being like the extra who was smashed in. Like, that would be terrible. Because, you know, they didn't do that in one take. Also, that would have been so uncomfortable.
Yeah, I just think bring there up was someone like stuff. Calling out the rhythm. Like, there had to have been some, like, all right, left, right. Like,
that's
like
an advantage of silent film is right. Is the director would just have a megaphone, basically.
Yeah.
You know, you see those old-timey megaphones, right? That's just basically a big cone.
Yeah.
They would yell out it, yeah, with a handle on it, exactly.
So, because like I said, the especially like those steps stand out. Like, they're synced up to the music. Did the director just have a rough idea of the tempo that ultimately they were going to go for there, and then the music was written after the fact, or like,
yes,
is some so okay, that's how it, yeah.
So they would have screened the finished cut to the composer, and then the composer went away and wrote something, and then at the actual time, the orchestra is there while the movie is playing, so the conductor can see the film as he's conducting, so he can lock into the tempo.
Interesting.
Just like nowadays, if you go watch one of those modern, I don't know if you guys have ever seen those, where it's like live orchestra to, say, Star Wars or Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I feel like this would be a better movie if we watched it together, like in a big space like that.
Oh, yeah.
You'd definitely be like picking up the different emotional reactions from the people around you. I think it'd be a lot more entertaining than just watching it on your tablet, sitting in bed, or however you
want. I unmuted it and yelled, yay, boobs, at Paul.
Yeah.
Actually, I believe my exact words were, hold on, I wrote it down. Woo nipples.
So I downloaded a potato quality version from YouTube and watched that. So anytime there was low contrast stuff on screen, it was just horribly compressed and muddied and like just looked bad. So he said that, and I was like, yeah, if I use my imagination enough, I can believe that that's what's on screen. But
look, I'm just saying, Metropolis is a movie that demands the 4K experience. This is probably, what, 2K at best?
Well, if you rent it on Amazon, you get the little pop-up trivia things, which I was like, I'm going to go through and watch this again like, while it's still the rental period, and then I'll read all
Nipples
of those
are things. Coming up now.
Yeah, I don't, who knows, maybe it said that. I never went back and watched the trivia, but I'm sure it had some interesting things.
The first piece of trivia is nipples show up at 32 minutes and 15 seconds. You can skip right there.
Every other fun fact is they count down to the nipple. Yeah.
Time until next glimpse of nipple.
So it's always hard to tell with an older film like this, like how much of it is innovative, like some of the shot techniques and things, because if it's really successful, then it's like you don't even notice it, right? It could be like the first time that a particular technique has been used, but there's a couple in here that I was like, oh, that's really cool, and I don't see that anymore. And one of them was, well, okay, I have seen Hardcore Henry, Doug, but there was like a first person perspective shot of like her hand like grabbing, or his, was it his hand? Someone's
his
hand grabbing
was,
out
I think
for
grabbing her shawl or something.
Yeah, from underneath a door. And it only comes up once in the movie. But it's like, oh, well,
there
that's
was also
neat.
The moment where like the camera staggers by like swinging almost like
yes.
a pendulum.
That's
I noticed.
The other one. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Probably pretty tricky to do, so you wouldn't see it very often, but
right. Especially given how heavy cameras would be, I think, at that point. And how easily they would jam or, you know, misfire or whatever. They don't really fire, but you know what I mean.
I was a big fan of that shot at, like, towards the very beginning, looking at the worker city from the elevator perspective. I don't know if we saw anything like that afterwards, but that was pretty interesting. I mean, it kind of showed, I mean, how elaborate the miniature must have been set up. I don't really know that much about all the modeling and everything that had to happen, but it was really impressive.
Yeah, because some of the things I thought were looked like they were fairly small. And then when the water started coming in, I was like, oh, that's a bit bigger than I thought it was. Because water is something
like
that's hard to
that's
miniaturize.
Like a 6-foot tall building or something, you know.
But then the actual sets that they built too, like when everybody's like the worker city and everybody right before the flood starts and everybody's down on the ground and, you know, nobody's really going into the doorways, but it still looks like they, you know, they built sets that probably were like at least 20 feet tall.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
How much, again, did this money, like, okay, in today dollars, how much did this movie cost to produce?
Oh, you're going to make me do math. Double math, probably.
I don't know. Wikipedia gives you some information on it.
Oh, wow. It actually does. Roughly, according to Wikipedia, equivalent to roughly 21 million euros as of 2021.
That's not too much.
I was going to say less than I would have expected.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's no water
very
world.
Extraordinarily impressive for a 100-year-old movie.
Yeah.
Well, they weren't paying the union fees. Like the union wage.
That is true. Yeah.
They were just telling the kids, like, we'll give you some bread and we won't kill you. Like, come and make a movie.
Cold children. We drug them through the water. $3 expended.
Yeah, like, there's no way they could do that now. If you watched the Making of Thor documentary that was on Disney Plus, and like they talked about the trouble of hiring the kid actors for the most recent one, like there's a lot of hoops to jump through. And for Metropolis, they just like go find some orphans or some kids whose parents didn't care and just threw them in some water and hoped it turned out. But to make it about money again. There was supposed to be a remaking of Metropolis as a TV series for Apple, Well, it's a streaming series for Apple. And it was one of the first things to get canceled during the writer's strike because it was going to be too expensive. And they'd already started the pre-production, like building sets and hiring crew in Australia. And they said that because they didn't know how long the writer's strike would last, and then there was already the impending actor's strike as well, they couldn't justify like holding the film production until those things ended, so they shut it down. That was sad.
Yeah, except it was going to be on Apple Plus, so no one was going to watch it anyway.
Oh, please, Ted Lasso.
But it would have been excellent quality, but no one ever watches anything on Apple Plus, and thus can ever confirm.
So what does everyone think of the character of Rote Von? We haven't really talked about him, the crazy inventor.
So I want to know the story with Rote Von's hands, because I was really like, at first I was like, it's cool that he's wearing those gloves. Like that's a style choice that he has made and he's owning it. But then I was like, wait, this is like an Empire Strikes, or excuse me, Return of the Jedi thing. Like that is a robot hand.
Yeah, because he says, yeah, he lost it.
Yeah,
right?
Says that. Yeah, we get the backstory for his hands.
Kind
I think
of,
that's exciting.
But it was
Wait,
like
it's just one hand though. Yeah, it's just his right hand.
All right. So tell me if I missed something here. He says he lost his hand, but he would give it up again for her. Did like he lose his hand but then didn't she die from
lost it while making the machine.
Oh, he lost it while making the machine. Oh, okay.
So it wasn't a voluntary... I got the impression at first that he was like, yes, I had to use my hand, like, for the thing, you know? Not just that it was an unintended side effect.
So it's it's just her, but, like, it's got this man hand on there, too.
Yeah. I had to give up an appreciable part of my humanity.
I ran out of hands. I had to use my own.
So Rote Von, crazy mad scientist.
Heck yeah.
He's like
also got the love triangle in there too.
Yeah, I like how he had that creepy, like he's like, here, just come down to my underground lair. I got a little hole blasted in the wall. Now get out of here. This is my viewing spot.
And like they let him exist in the upper world in his little up house. Like it looked like the house from Up because it had all the skyscrapers around it. And like that was because we were watching it. My husband was like, wait, does he just have stairs that go into the basement and the basement is the workers like civilization? And I was like, I guess so. Like that's just the connection between the worlds. I don't know.
He was going to be the original heart, but then he went mad.
Yeah. See, I was wondering about that too, especially with his hand being missing. Like he didn't quite fit in either world. But I did love his house. If I could have lived in one of the houses, it would have probably been that one.
I didn't really expect him to betray Frederson and to say, like, I'm just going to blow everything up. I just want everyone to die. Why not? Like, that's his plan. It's just like, all right, we're just going to cause chaos.
In the greater story of, like, you know, the worker versus the, you know, quote unquote ruling class, I didn't quite understand what he represented or if they just decided they needed a full-on antagonist to throw in. Like, I didn't get what his metaphorical role in the story was exactly.
Voice of the people. Vox populi.
I mean,
the
certainly,
crazy
guy? I mean, certainly Wait, catalyst, you know, for the story, but I don't know. Yeah.
I stopped listening, so I just took a guess on what we were talking about.
You're good.
I would say you're wrong. He's more like about? People in the upper crust just having their little fights with each other, and the little guy suffers the consequences.
My initial question was if, you know, Frederson and co. are the Trumps and Musks and the worker class are the still worker class today. Like, what role does the inventor play? Like, who is
he like a Joe Rogan? I know we have
Caesar
to cut all
Catalina,
this.
I established this. This is a sequel to Megalopolis.
Wait, so you're saying that Caesar Catalina turned evil?
Yep. Well, because his wife died.
Oh.
I don't know who's the WoW Platinum replacement in this story, but...
I kind of related to Rote Von because... I don't even know if I'm saying his name right, but...
You got it right.
Cool. I like fifth grade German coming through. I liked that he was kind of the one who was like, well, everyone's stupid. Like the industrialists are stupid because they're oppressing everyone and living their like life of luxury while other people are suffering. And the workers are suffering and not rising up against their oppressors. And so he like instigated the turmoil that takes up so much of the latter part of the movie. I mean, as a person who was not alive in 1927, I was like, yeah, good for him. Like, let's cause some destruction. But I don't know if the rooting for destruction would have been something that the people who had survived World War I would have felt at the time.
And you know, that actually answers my question to a great degree. I mean, he is basically, I don't know, modern day 4chan, like, I don't know, someone who is intelligent and is just so fed up with everyone else that he just wants to tear it all down. Yeah, no, I see that. I like that.
Do you mean the Joker rather than 4chan?
I was actually thinking the Joker, but I mean 4chan, you know, they have a similar vibe.
Yeah, I'm just trying to reduce not the number of things we have to cut.
Not V from V Thank for you, Vendetta, Adam. But people who imagine themselves to be like V from V for Vendetta.
Oh,
see, I was imagining the dudes from Fight Club. And he even had a basement set up that he could use for Fight Club.
Yeah.
It's a prequel to Fight Club. Now I do understand.
Wait, so you're saying that Fight Club and Megalopolis are part of a trilogy?
Well, they are now.
All right, we have our film festival, guys.
We're going to play these three movies. We think the reason for it is obvious. Enjoy.
The doors are locked. You cannot leave during Megalopolis.
Much like the doors in Rotvang's house. They just open and close when we want them to, when it's convenient.
So just going back to the visuals a bit, one of the things I liked was that in a number of cases, the inner titles aren't just telling you dialogue, but like they're also evoking mood, like the way like they're moving around or like dripping at one point. Like the one for like Babel, for instance. And I thought that was pretty interesting and not really something I'd ever seen with intertitles before on silent films.
Oh yeah, and the actual title card itself too at the beginning of the movie. I remember that being pretty striking.
I could have a 10-minute conversation about the fonts with you all. Literally pausing it and I was like, look at the font on the clocks. Like, that's beautiful. Like, I'm a really fun person to watch movies with, because when they had the clock that was in, like, the upper world, I was like, look at the number 2. That's a beautiful 2. And my husband was like, okay, can we get through this, like, 3-hour movie now? like, there's so many design elements like that that are so pretty, like the lamps and all kinds of
little things. One of them had like a weird spiral lamp that almost like came to a point or something at the top. Like some of the futuristic stuff did. I mean, it's like, ooh, look at this like fancy like ticker tape thing that we have. But their lamp technology, that's spot on for what I want the future to look like.
Oh, yeah. They got FaceTime, too.
Yeah.
That was actually it was very.
Oh, that was. Yeah. Little yes. Sequence. Yeah. That part was very cool.
You have to dial into it just right, but
I also like all the work clocks are decimalized.
Oh yeah, I was like, say what you will about this dystopia, but they've got a base 10 clock.
But only for work, because they show a shot of a wristwatch that's the regular 12-hour.
Well, yeah, they're 10-hour shifts, so it counts to the
Oh,
if you're underground, you don't need to worry about the 24-hour schedule anyway.
But also he's like trying to get the clock to 2 o'clock, not like 1 or 10 or whatever. So
that's a good point.
Wait, what?
Something went wrong somewhere along the line. Well, he's trying to get his shift to be over. So he's trying to like metaphorically drag the clock to 2. But if it's a 10-hour clock based on the work shift, why is it 2? Why isn't it 10?
Wasn't 2 when the guy told him that the meeting was going to be, or when the shift, the stuff with Maria was going to happen.
Oh yeah, that is how two.
And he was all horned up for Maria. So
there was a lot of paper for it being in the future, though. They had a lot of paper that they used for stuff.
I just think that's the '20s, man. I don't think anyone.
Yeah.
I don't think you predict a non-paper future until really
70s, maybe?
90s, maybe. No, 70s had tape. I mean, I guess, yeah, they had tape, magnetic tape and stuff. So I guess that's not the paper. But
I hear what y'all are saying, but working in healthcare, like the amount of things that are still regularly faxed from place to place is pretty outrageous. I mean, it's not as gone as it should be.
Wait, do you guys still fax things?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like records requests, like there's some things they just really like, it's safe.
But don't you
like,
want to keep the original documents? That was for you, Paul.
Yeah.
So the work that Frater was doing with the clock hands, like, did anybody else think that looked like like a video game mini game?
Yes, I wrote that down.
Where it's like the light bulb Welcome lights up and you have to pull the arm of the clock to it in order to make it stop, in order to shut off that light. And then another one lights up and you have to, you know, do the next one. It actually sounds pretty cool and fun, although maybe not for 10 hours straight.
This felt very much to be like something that would be in a children's museum. You know, exactly. It's like 5 minutes. I would love to do that for 5 minutes and then move on to another machine. Right. 10 hours. I felt that though. I'd be like, oh yeah, I'd be pretty exhausted after 10 hours too.
Oh, this is why unions exist.
In a world without automated control systems.
Now that you brought up unions, I'm wondering if that is the actual end of the movie, because the movie, I mean, it has some resolution, like, yay, they shake hands, but it doesn't actually, I mean, this is because it's a dystopia, it doesn't actually tell us what's going to happen, like, later, and if there's going to be resolution between the two parts of society.
He's literally called the mediator.
I know. Like, I mean, they have mediators in unions, right? So maybe that is the implied fifth act, if you will. But what do you all think about the end? Was it satisfying, or were you just like, yes, it's over and I can go to the bathroom now?
It was a little too quick, the ending, for me. Like, they shake hands, the end. Like, it resolved a little too tidily, which maybe isn't a fair criticism for me to, you know, wage against. Like, I mean, I don't know when the quote-unquote first movie period was released, but I mean, this obviously was revolutionary at the time. Holding my current standards to something that was released 100 years ago may not be fair, but I would have liked to see a little bit more epilogue in there.
You want the movie to be longer?
I mean, I'll be honest, I did split it across two nights, but like, I could have used another 10 minutes or so of just, you know, resolution at the end.
How I felt about it was that, okay, it does have the mission statement at the beginning, so it's kind of the ending that you expect, but it's always weird to have something kind of come down in the middle. Like, you kind of expect this to be like, oh, maybe it's going to be like an Ayn Rand movie where it's like, get out of the way of the really brilliant people, or it's going to be like, you know, Battleship Potemkin or something, right? You kind of expect it to go one way or the other, and it's kind of like, no, I think capitalism's fine. We just work together, right?
And you're like, it's a right. real centrist film.
It feels like that.
Part of me wants to be like, this is going to go bad really fast. Because, I mean, how is anyone going to benefit from this transitory alliance between the groups? It doesn't have the potential for long-term success. And it seems like there would really quickly be some devolving into the way things were. Or, you know,
so,
like...
You mentioned Broadway earlier, and that comment makes me think of the ending of the musical Urinetown, which very broadly, and I guess general spoilers for Urinetown, but Urinetown is a musical about a place where you have to pay a lot of money to use the bathroom, and it's highly rationed for various reasons. And so then the workers basically overthrow the elites. And then the last, like, 5 minutes of the musical is basically a description of how, like, that happened, and then everything goes to because they're like, oh, it turns out all these restrictions were in place for a reason.
Well, now I'm wondering about the bathroom situation in Metropolis. Like, did the industrialists just have it go down into the crypts? And, like, that wasn't actually water that flooded?
Oh. You do listen to this podcast, Amber. We talk about this all the time when we review movies. So 1927's Metropolis. We've seen it. What did y'all think? Did you enjoy it? Adam, how about you?
What a segue. Incredible. Love it. I think I definitely appreciated it more this time. I think having a general idea of what I was getting into, more than just the vague images of pop culture, I think kind of helped than the first time when I, like I said, I was a little bit bored and disconnected. So I can see why my fellow crass Americans would cut an hour out of this. But this time around, I think I definitely appreciated it more. And yeah, it's a good movie. Don't know if I would recommend it for everyone. I think part of it is just going to be your tolerance for silent films and then longer silent films as a result. I think it's just an unfortunate fact of life that current generations aren't necessarily keyed into that particular style of film. And I don't know that this is the one I would start people off with. I'd probably start them off with a Chaplin or something like that. But I definitely enjoyed it. It's I can see why it's so well regarded. And I am glad that the nearly complete version exists so we can see a lot more of like character motivations and some extra complications and stuff. So that was cool too.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I have not ever seen a silent film this old, this long. I went in seeing the length and saying like, okay, well, I'll subject myself to this so we can talk about it. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I agree. This is not a movie I would recommend to most people, frankly, but I think there's, real artistic value to it. I'm not going to watch it again next week, but I could absolutely see myself returning to this in the future. I am glad that this was picked. And Adam, you picked it. Is that right? Thank you, Adam.
Yep. You're welcome.
Yeah, it was all right. Probably if you're going to watch it, make sure you find a decent picture quality copy. And for something that is billed as a silent film, I thought it was surprising that the score never, ever, ever, ever lets up. There is no silence in this movie.
Oh, that's just
like beginning to end. It's just constant noise. And that got a little oppressive after a couple hours. And then there was still another half hour to go. But the story was decent. The visuals were good. The acting, I thought, was very good. It's just a very, like, the first probably two acts are very slow paced. So then it picks up near the end, but it was a little bit boring starting out. A little bit slow, I should say, starting out.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was picking up on the first time I watched it. But like I said, the second time it was a little better once I knew what the pacing was and stuff. Which is to say that past me agrees with Doug.
But never allow your current self to agree with Doug. That's the rule.
Gotta be one step ahead. It's one opinion ahead.
Always evolving.
Yeah, I used to think that. That's valid.
When I was a baby.
You know what? You know what?
You call this slicked back? This is pushed back.
This is the best offer I am going to get from him. I am going to take it.
Paul.
So yeah, I really, really enjoyed this. I think I didn't mention at the beginning, I watched the first act of 3 many years ago. And I was like, I'm going to watch the rest of that later, and then never did. And I'm really glad that I went back and did it. I wasn't expecting the third act to be so jam-packed with action. You know, I was kind of ready for, you know, some heady silent film sci-fi that was kind of slow. And then little did I know there was just going to be a really long, crazy action scene at the end. And, you know, I was into it. Also, probably in a somewhat opposite opinion of you, Doug, I really enjoyed the relentless score, and it solidified my decision to purchase a conducting baton of my own to just keep in the living room because I was like swinging my remote around and I was like, this is too heavy. I need something that really like
either so, conducting baton or a Harry Potter wand.
Conducting baton. Not the Harry Potter. I don't want to accidentally like make my TV disappear.
Oh, shoot. There was one other thing that I forgot to mention that I liked, which was that they burned the witch and they burned the right one.
That's true. You know,
maybe that's what all the clock imagery was about, broken clocks or something like that. I don't know.
You know, that was true, though, because I just, even though I saw that it was the right one, I was like, they put the wrong one up there, right? This is, we don't want her to die. And then I was like, no, she's squinting. I guess they did get the right one. I just expect that.
Like, you saw the way she moved, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's the robot.
Yeah.
I like how quickly they produced and or pre-prepared that pile of timber. I don't know. It was huge.
I totally thought of Les Mis for that moment. I was like, they've made a barricade.
Oh, speaking of French things, sorry, I thought of one other thing that I forgot to mention. I like that they kept playing the French national anthem randomly the workers were rebelling. Just nothing else to say but that, but I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
So I liked this, which is why I'm here. But I think I liked it for different reasons than you all. Like, I wasn't prepared to come here talking about nipples a lot, and actually... Hearing you all talk about it makes me really grateful that we had the shorter cut when I taught high school, because I didn't have to deal with that with a bunch of 16-year-olds. But I think there is a version of Metropolis that is yet to be made that I would like better. And that's one where someone just cuts every shot by 10 to 30 seconds and they just shave it down so it gets the better pacing that Doug wants. It cuts some runtime without losing the story, because we don't have to see the close-ups of their eyes for like a solid 25 seconds. Give us 15 seconds. We get the point. So that's my favorite version of Metropolis. So maybe someone who's listening can make that.
If you would like to bastardize Metropolis, talk to Amber.
What's Topher Grace up to? Come on. Yeah, I like this movie a lot. I thought it kind of rocked. I mean, yeah, it clocks in at a pretty long length, but I'm always surprised at what things they try to remake. And sometimes I'm usually very surprised at what works and what doesn't, but I don't know why you would even bother with something like this. It still works really well. I mean, it doesn't come off quite as much of a vision of the future, I suppose, as it did at that time, just because everything's progressed so much since then, but I don't think it really needs to either. It's just kind of in its own universe. And yeah, the acting was great. And I was actually surprised too at how much of the imagery I didn't recognize. I mean, a lot of it is very iconic, but just a lot of surprises in it too. I enjoyed it pretty much start to finish.
And it didn't feel like a 100-year-old movie. There are things in it where it's like, oh, they're wearing clothes with natural fibers. But in terms of like the story and the themes, it's the same today. We can relate to it really well. So even though people are like, it's so old, I don't like silent movies, or like my kids say, I don't want to watch something in black and white, it still works. It's aged a lot better than other things that are 100 years old.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us on this installment of the Sci-Fi Shuffle. And a particular thanks to Amber Elby for coming back onto the podcast. It's not cinematic respect, but it's close-ish, I guess.
And we still have respect, and we talk about cinema, so it works.
Yeah, but also nipples, so covered the whole gamut. So since this is your first time on the Sci-Fi Shuffle, and I did warn you about this ahead of time, so this isn't completely coming out of nowhere, but we invite you to pick our next sci-fi movie to watch. So what should we watch next, Amber?
Well, I am so grateful for this opportunity, and I put way too much thought into this. I'll share my process with you, which was actually much longer than this, but the abbreviated version is I looked through your list and I was like, oh, well, you haven't seen Stargate, and Stargate would be good because it starts in the 1920s and Metropolis was in the 1920s. But then I was like considering other things that would be more niche. And so my next thought was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, because I just made my screenwriting students read that script by Charlie Kaufman. And then I watched that and I cried a whole bunch at the end. So I was like, no to that one. So my final answer is the movie that I should have watched. I know, right? So my final answer is the movie that I should have watched on November 5th instead of Metropolis, and that is V for Vendetta.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
Which is available for streaming on Amazon Prime and I'm assuming other places too. But that was where I watched it.
Oh, sneaking in a DC movie here.
Oh, it means we won't have to watch it again, or we will.
No, it'll be like the time we did Guardians and then did Guardians again.
That's true, yeah.
So, all right, V for Vendetta, 2006. Well, thank you, Amber, for that. I was going to say suggestion, but it's really more of a requirement. So, for your pick. Thank you for your pick, Amber.
Thank you. Thank you for those parameters.
Yes.
And I appreciate this power because I've been trying to convince my two teenagers to watch that freaking movie for like years and they just keep on shooting it down. So it's really refreshing to like say something and be listened to. So thank you for that.
I mean, the real question is, does my HD DVD copy still work?
Am I okay with watching my full screen DVD copy? Is that fine?
Full screen.
I'm pretty sure it's full screen.
It's important now that you've set the precedent of watching being the most suboptimal viewing experience. It's your job to observe and report that end of things.
All right. Well, yes. So thank you, Amber, for that. And thank you for joining us here on the Gobeski Waltz Report.
So yeah, seriously, thanks for having me, you guys. It was fun. I asked Tony, who's my husband, for those of you who don't know him, if he wanted to say hi to you. And he texted me. I said, do you want to come say hi? And he said, I'm good. And then in another text, he goes, tell everyone I say hi.
What's the time span between those two texts? How much time did he think that over?
It was like a good minute.
Nice. I'd like to also say a special thanks to our three more or less regular guests. We had Doug Gobeski.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Wilcox.
It was a pleasure.
And Kevin Vredevoog.
Hey, it's been a blast.
And I'm Adam Gobeski.
And I'm Charlie Wallace.
So I guess we'll see you all next time in the future.
So if you enjoyed that episode of the Gobeski Wallace Report, it doesn't have to stop there.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
Are we gonna reveal the secrets?
I'm ready if you are.
I mean, I guess they can start by following us on Facebook.
Or Twitter. Or just go to the old-fashioned internet to GobeskiWallaceReport.com.
Search AOL keyword Gobeski Wallace Report.
I think you can find us actually in the Yahoo directories if you click on entertainment, audio, miscellaneous. Ooh.
I think in honor of Metropolis, this 2.5 hour recording should be cut down to a solid 84 minutes.
But then you have to burn the rest. Like, yes. You have to destroy it.
Yeah, then I'll just come on, Mike, and say, and this is the part where Doug said something. And Adam was going to make me cut anyway, but we don't remember what it was.